Welcome, everyone, and thanks for being with me this next hour. You are listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks on 1-2 Radio, where we talk about A Course in Miracles. And in fact, I think in our header, it's always called A Study in A Course in Miracles. And we're just trying to keep you on your toes. I just so love saying the Friday Morning Show. I don't know why I resist calling it A Course in Miracles. But that is what we're talking about every week here on Friday. Now, of course, as you've noticed, though, we have changed our time. We are no longer in that 8 a.m. Pacific time slot. We're in the 9 a.m. Pacific time slot. And I'm even trying to kind of do a little double take, make sure I'm on to that because I'm in the mountain time zone. And, you know, just when you get used to something, then you change it. And so I'm just hoping that I really have this time slot right. But thank you so much for finding us. And I also want to shout out and say thanks to those of you for your nice comments about last week's show. We replayed an interview that Mark Hessen had done with Ken Wapnick a few years ago. And I'll tell you what, it is so precious to me. I mean, just absolutely precious. It was so exciting for all of us when Ken agreed to do that interview with Mark, and he did it on the air. So I keep that in my archives, and about once a year, once every, you know, 18 months, I pull it out and play it because it's just, it's precious. And so thank you for your comments. I'm glad you enjoyed it. And I don't have that show in the archives yet, but I promise I will. I'm kind of a little behind with my archives, and I apologize for that. But this afternoon, I plan to get on to that and make sure that I update all of that. So you will find all the last, like, 3 to 4 shows, I think, in the archives by this afternoon. I will do that. So this morning, Bruce Rawls is with me, and we are going to talk about the workbook for students. We're going to go back to that because I like to keep touching base with where we are in terms of the lessons. But rather than the actual lessons, what we're going to look at, you know, in part two of the workbook, there are essays, or people call them different things. Sometimes they're called essays. I call them instructions, but little vignettes, whatever you want to say. But they're questions like, what is sin? You know, what is salvation? And in this case, we're going to talk about what is the world. And I chose that one for a variety of reasons. One, because I don't know about you, but I feel like the world is such a changing landscape anymore. I don't know what the world is. And so it kind of is a great curriculum for putting it in the context of A Course in Miracles and realizing our projections and realizing, you know, we make it what we want it to be. But if you notice in the workbook, I also selected that one because of the timing, because that's a lesson that it's right before lesson 241, which is on August 29th. So we're pretty much getting close to that. If, you know, you're one of those people that you do the lessons one a day and you started on January 1st, then you're almost up to this particular essay, which is what is the real world? Now, or I'm sorry, what is the world? But you'll notice in about 2 months when we get into October, the essay question is, what is the real world? And that's something in A Course in Miracles that every once in a while is discussed. So I thought, you know, we may steer into that territory as well. I don't want to get, you know, one thing I don't want is a lot of confusion. And yet, you know, I'm kind of feeling confused myself right now. I mean, I do. I don't know as an astrologer if it's all the retrogrades, but I'm feeling like I'm kind of going in circles and all over the place, and I don't feel particularly grounded. So I'm just confessing that right up front. I don't feel very grounded. So I thought this would be a great lesson to talk about what is the world, but we may also be talking about what is the real world. And for those of you who have A Course in Miracles, if you will pull out the workbook for students, or later, if you go back to the workbook for students, you will find those essays in part two of that workbook. So I also want to shout out and say, hey, thanks for all of you who are coming into the chat room this morning. It's so good to see you. It's always fun. And, you know, your old friends there, you know, coming in and talking, and Greg and Liliana and Laura and everybody. Thank you so much. And Lynn, I really appreciate your coming in. And Quelly, I see you too. So thanks for coming. And for those of you who might be listening and saying, hey, I want to go into the chat room, you can find it by going over to 12radio.com. That's our website. On the left side of the page, you'll see the chat, you know, link. And when you click that, it automatically redirects you to the right page in Facebook, where if you haven't been there before, you can ask to join the group. And our producer today is Scott Weaver, and he will be at the door and he will let you in. So if you'd like to do that, you can join the other people that are already over in Facebook, and you can ask questions or, you know, make comments as we talk. So let's get Bruce on the air. Bruce, I am so happy that you're here today, and I just want to say thank you so much always for your flexibility. Oh, I just feel like you're just always there, you know, at the last minute, go, let's do this, let's do that. What's going on here? You're just like, you've always got my back, so I so appreciate that.
Well, it's mutual, and I always appreciate being on your show because it reminds me that there's some really great ideas and practices that I could make use of more myself. And so it's very much, you know, we help ourselves by helping others, you know, indirectly, I suppose. But, you know, the whole premise of A Course in Miracles, of course, is that, you know, there's just one of us, and that the belief in separation is really what gets us into all kinds of imaginary mischief. And we call that the world, which has that for a quick segue.
Right.
So anyway, but yes, thank you. Thank you as always for inviting me to be on the air with you in 1-2 Radio Land. And I always have fun conversing about these topics because they really are helpful. They really do give us an opportunity to deepen the peace that we always are and have in truth, but that we sometimes forget. And sometimes we forget for long stretches at a time, it would seem. And I think that's intentional by the insane part of our mind called the ego, as of course in Miracles refers to it. And that's the aspect of the dream thinking that we took with us, that we made up in this dream, and we take that insanity with us until we look at it carefully with another part of us that we took with us into the dream, you know, the Course calls the Holy Spirit, or I like to refer to as our inner kindness teacher, that is that gentle awareness, the calm, gentle strength that we have always 24/7, 365, that's able to, not in a derisive way, but gently just kind of laugh at the crazy shenanigans of this world. And as you point out, and we were talking before we started the recording, you know, it sometimes just seems like off the charts, bizarre sometimes, doesn't it?
Yes.
I mean, even if you don't watch the news.
Right.
Or listen to the news in whatever capacity. So, you know, I think it's important to you know, look at this world and its imaginary parameters of space and time and personas and bodies and everything from quarks to quasars and everything in between, and just recognize that this was made, and this is where I think the radical ideas in A Course in Miracles really have a practical value. This, because A Course in Miracles suggests that this world actually was made as an attack on that perfect oneness that we all are. So, and as a way to avoid the peace, which sounds crazy, but that's what a crazy thought system would do, right? Mm-hmm. And to avoid the peace that we really are, because we think, and for some bizarre reason, and this always seems to get back to the, you know, the core metaphysical idea of this curriculum, is that we think we blew up perfect oneness. We think we threw God under the bus, metaphorically. We think we shattered this wholeness and this perfect purity and innocence and perfection that we in truth could never lose, which is the real world that A Course in Miracles talks about. But instead, we made up this substitute world that is nothing but craziness with seeming, you know, stretches of sanity, which is really just a thin veneer over the insanity that's really there. And we have these, you know, relationships with everything in this world that seem to be outside ourselves. And of course, Miracles calls these special love and special hate relationships, because we want things to happen in the world certain ways, and we want other things to not happen. And so we, with everyone and everything, we have these special love and special hate relationships. The special love being when things seem to be going, quote, our way, unquote. Mm-hmm. And the special hate is that shadow side that surfaces when things don't seem to be going our way, whether it's a political figure or a family member or a work situation or a health situation or what have you. But it's this dance back and forth between, euphoric, not real happiness, but you know, just kind of think, oh well, now I've conquered the world, you know, this by this little bit when things seem to be going our way, and then, you know, lapsing back to maybe not so much when things don't seem to be going our way.
Right.
But it's the hour in our way that's the seemingly separate self that A Course in Miracles addresses square on and says, you know, have you ever bothered to think that maybe the idea of your identity is somewhat subject to question, and that identity as a separate self is really, you know, the cause of all this trouble. So it's kind of a stretch for everyone really to get our wrap our heads around the idea that maybe there's an identity that we all share. And I think that's kind of the way back into the peace that we never left, is to look at the shared interests that we have with everyone, because we deep down inside, everyone really just wants to have a peace that's unshakable. And that's really what we're all here for. But we've covered that over with and you know, barricaded the door, so to speak, in our minds with all kinds of substitute goals and values and interests and the what's in it for me list that if unfurled would scroll out the door and down the street and around the planet a few times probably for most people.
Right.
So if we could just look at those things and see that the world is purposive, and I think that's one of the things that's so brilliant about Ken Wapnick's work, which I'm looking forward to that replay with Mark, by the way, when you have it posted. Yeah. So brilliant about Ken Wapnick's prolific and profound work is that one of the things he's shared in a number of ways is that the world is purposive. And that it's not just this random thing, but it's really meant to keep us mindless. And when I was working in the corporate world, we talked about, you know, getting out of firefighting mode when you could actually work on new products rather than have to fix old ones and, you know, things like that. If you can think about how the world is designed to keep us constantly fighting fires. And in my case, it's a sort of a literal geographic phenomena, since I just flew into California last night and over a good portion of Oregon's western coast and saw hardly anything but smoke and a whole lot of it going over the Clear Lake area of Northern California. Mm. But that's part of the smoke screen, you know, metaphor intended, that the ego puts out to keep us constantly looking where the solution is never going to be found. And that's why the Course points out, you know, the seek but do not find principle is really the ego's, you know, maxim. It's basically, it's always getting us to think that, well, it's about the other person, or it's about the politician, or it's about, you know, my body, and if that could only behave, or somebody else's body, or a collection of bodies, and you know, whether it's a, you know, a nation, or a community, or a workplace, or a family, you know, it doesn't really matter, that anything that seems to be outside becomes the perfect, you know, a Machiavellian, if you will, distraction for keeping us in a mindless matrix where, you know, we're dreaming, but fortunately it's not this sinister thing. It's just silly. And I think, again, that's another thing where Ken Wapnick points out in so much of his work, that it's not evil, sinful, or wicked. It's just silly that we have made such a big deal over the world. It doesn't mean that we stop caring or stop relating to people on a practical, you know, everyday, you know, down to earth level about things that are befalling people. You know, I talked with my mother when I got here last night about, you know, some of her health concerns and things going on with people that we both know. And you know, why wouldn't I do that? You know,
right.
So, but I think at the same time, if we can kind of remember that what we really are is spirit, and then keep that, you know, not too far buried, and while we're having these conversations, you know, whether it's in our mind or out loud with other people, that's really what we're here for, where we're here to undo the belief in a world that we've equated with our identity. And if our identity is truly spirit, which is bigger than anything that space and time could possibly contain, and tag, we're all it, that's the good news, and it's a completely innocent, joyously perfect, beautiful being that we all are and share, then that then becomes something that gradually replaces the identification with a world that's beset with problems and thinking, you know, which really, you know, it's kind of an endless, you know, like the Sisyphus myth, you know, we're forever rolling the stone up the hill only to come crashing down on us. And this world really is a Sisyphus world, and that all the things that seem to be happening to us, you know, we might have a momentary respite from some of those things. But then, you know, as Rosanna Dana said on Saturday Live, it's always something, right?
Yeah.
Just when you think you've got one thing solved, something else crops up. But that's intentional.
Yes.
Because the world is designed for that craziness.
Right. Well, and I had an interesting experience recently. I was traveling for a few days, and when I travel, I always read novels. Uh-huh. And I read a series. I really like David Baldacci, which is kind of weird. Susan Dugan and I have talked about this because, you know, we both tend to read these novels that are just gruesome, you know, and I'm like, yeah, here I am on a plane with A Course in Miracles book and some gruesome novel, you know. And she goes, yeah, she goes, I do the same thing. And, you know, she said, I remember going, in fact, to California to some of the workshops. And she goes, I'd go back to my hotel room and read some grisly thing, you know. And she goes, maybe I just was looking for balance or something. I don't know. But in any case, I always look forward to pulling out one of his novels. And he writes in series. Uh-huh. And this is important for a couple reasons. But I had a novel that is one of his older ones. And quite frankly, I just wasn't getting into it. And it wasn't that good. But it's the one I brought. So I was reading it. But before I had left, I had actually, you know, finished up my column for Mark's Power Peak. And as I was writing the very last line, I remember what came into my mind was, the meek shall inherit the earth. And the minute I wrote it, I said, okay, that's not me. You know, that's just not me. I don't know where that line came from. But then I kind of looked at it in the context of what I'd written. And I said, but you know what? It fits. I'm going to leave it. It's not quite like me to be quoting the Bible, but I'm going to leave it. So I'm reading this novel, and towards the very end, all of a sudden, there's that line, the meek shall inherit the earth. And I just kind of started laughing, because what it said to me is, I wasn't particularly enjoying the novel. I don't think it's one of his better ones. But what it said to me is, you know what? Everything can be used. Nothing has to be a mistake. It can always be used for a purpose. And even though maybe I'm always looking for meaning in something, but I thought that was kind of a reminder that, you know, everything can have a purpose regardless, you know, instead of going, oh, this isn't a good novel. I'm not enjoying this. This isn't whatever. It's like everything can have a purpose. But then what was even funnier is then I had picked up a novel because I finished it and I wanted something by somebody else. So I picked up a new novel by a really great writer who I really enjoy. And I pick it up. And damn, if in the first couple of pages, he's talking about a scientist that was referred to in the other book. And I thought, oh, my God.
It's all connected, huh?
I can't believe this. It was. It was like it was all connected. But for me, once again, the message was, everything can have a purpose. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to overly go, oh, my God, this is destined. But it's just more that everything can have a purpose. Everything can be part of your curriculum in life. You don't have to judge it as good or bad. You just look at it and see what it is. And it has a purpose. And so that was kind of a good just little lesson for me. And then, by the way, somewhere else during the week, I heard somebody say the meek shall inherit the earth. And so I thought, okay, well, if nothing else, I'm tuning into mass consciousness. You know, it was just kind of a funny thing that was going on there. So in any case, I just wanted to share that story with you.
Well, that's neat. Well, yeah, well, synchronistically, I just watched a documentary this past week that was thoroughly enjoyable, and I highly recommend for anybody who hasn't seen it, about a character who exhibited all the positive qualities of meekness in a really wonderful and gentle way, and that is Fred Rogers, who had the Mr. Rogers TV show on PBS for years. There's this wonderful documentary that's on Amazon. You can get it, watch it streaming from through your TV or whatever, and it's about his life, and it was basically narrated by a person who literally was his neighbor on Nantucket Island, where he had a guest cottage apparently, or a summer cottage, whatever. And anyway, this fellow whose name I've forgotten, but he's the narrator, basically interviews all these other people and has its own comments too about how profoundly they were influenced by Mr. Rogers' very gentle, kind of unconditionally accepting way with people, where he, you know, gave everyone their full attention and would not go anywhere near anything that was demeaning. And that was the one place that he wouldn't go, which sounds like a very familiar curriculum, doesn't it? That, you know,
yes.
our grievances and our, you know, the issues and the judgments that we have about ourselves and each other are what get us into all kinds of trouble. Not that we don't notice the data coming in from our senses, it's just we don't use the ego's interpretation of that information, those little ones and zeros or pixels or voxels or whatever little, you know, the smallest little bit of sensory data that comes in that is I like the word feedback too, because the word feedback implies that it's, you know, it connotes that it's really something that's already come from us and now it's just coming back to us as a reflection in the mirror. And that ties into what you were just saying, is that we can use everything as a lesson, everything as a classroom experience, because everything is either that comes back to us is either an expression of love or a call for it. And so the appropriate response to everything is an expression of loving kindness. And this is what Fred Rogers in his documentary evidently demonstrated in great measure throughout his life and very consistently. And I think that's why he was such an inspiration to the people that were interviewed on this show. When I was fixing TVs for a living in a past life, it's not too many years ago, although it seems like a while now, I remember having his show on in the afternoons when I was, you know, usually rooting around in the back of a TV for a solid state module or some of the older ones, a vacuum tube. So I'm dating myself. You know, that show would be on and I'd flip through the channels and turn the knob, and also dating myself on those TVs. And, and when his, you know, show flipped on, I thought, well, that's probably a really good kid show, but I really didn't pay too much attention to it. But I just thought, well, hey, you know, and even then I could tell that, you know, he was a very gentle, patient person. And, you know, the patience and the gentleness are some of the characteristics that A Course in Miracles suggests are, you know, a kind of a good indicator that we're practicing this curriculum and remembering to not take this world quite so seriously and personally, and to, you know, let everybody, including ourselves, off the hook, right?
Right.
That's I think, a good thing.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a great documentary. I'm going to look it up. And, you know, I think I have seen it.
Okay.
I mean, I have not seen it. I've seen it listed or advertised somewhere in Netflix, you know, world. Like, you know, you get those texts or emails, hey, new on Netflix. I'm pretty sure that came across. So I'll go look that up. Yeah. But you also said something that I think is just so core to A Course in Miracles that is important, is that it's our interpretation.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what, in a sense, this particular essay talks about. You know, it starts with the idea of the world is a false perception. That, you know, we always think whatever is coming in our sensory world, that there really is one interpretation. Good, bad, ugly, beautiful, whatever. And we forget. And that's what A Course in Miracles keeps telling us. What is your purpose? What is your intention for your seeing? And when we change the purpose, then the interpretation of the world changes as well.
Exactly. Exactly.
And so, yeah, should we read some of this?
Yes. Do you want to finish that paragraph?
Sure. Yeah. So the world is false perception. It is born of error and it has not left its source. Another really important concept in A Course in Miracles. Things do not leave their source.
Yep.
It will remain no longer than the thought that gave it birth is cherished. When the thought of separation has been changed to one of true forgiveness, will the world be seen in quite another light, and one which leads to truth, where all the world must disappear and all its errors vanish. Now its source has gone and its effects are gone as well.
Bam.
And by the way, you know, Gary Renard, who wrote the book Disappearance of the Universe, I don't remember exactly where he got the idea, but this is literally it. The world will be seen in quite another light and, in fact, will disappear. And not because the whole world blows up, but because what we think we see is changed. It's transformed.
Exactly. And it points out in the course and also in Gary's works, which I think, just a quick aside, I think the title of that was something that his teachers, Artin and Persa, quoted, and that became the title of his first book. But A Course in Miracles suggests that the world doesn't disappear in any kind of, you know, suffering or anguish, or certainly not in death as we think of it, because it says that this world is, as it starts out in this paragraph, false perception. It's a hallucination made by those mad with guilt. Mm-hmm. and that never really makes it directly to our, well, I should say infrequently makes it directly to our consciousness in that way. But how it comes to us, the unconscious guilt comes to us through intermediaries that we call news stories we don't like, or a comment from a family member, or a spouse, or, you know, a parent or child, or a coworker, or somebody on the road cutting us off, or something we get in the mail that we don't like, or a diagnosis that we're not happy with, you know, and when you go to the doctor, you know, it could be a myriad of things, but anything that is the least bit irritating or annoying or upsetting, that's a clue that we have more forgiveness work to do. That's the perfect feedback mechanism that says, and just it ties in perfectly to what you were just sharing earlier, is that we can use the world as a tool for looking at the inappropriateness and the ineffectiveness of the ego's interpretation of that data, and instead choose the Holy Spirit's translation, which is basically, you know, it kind of looks and waits and judges not, as the third. This is the third what is section we're reading from. But the mm-hmm. first one that starts off this whole series of the second part of the workbook, it says, you know, it, forgiveness is still and quietly does nothing. You know, it merely looks and waits and judges not. And that's the whole approach, is to just kind of stop, catch yourself, remember to be present, as Mr. Rogers was with people, and just say, wait a minute, do I want to promote an identity that is dysfunctional and that is demeaning to myself and everyone else, because minds are joined and ideas don't leave their source? Or do I want to kind of let go of what isn't working and instead choose a thought system of inclusion and shared interests and forgiveness, not making the world real, but seeing that there was no crime, there was no offense. And I think that comes with a lot of practice, but we start in moment to moment by just saying, would I rather see peace instead of how I'm interpreting right now, mm-hmm. what's going on right now? And I think that perpetual and persistent practice, until we generalize it and become second nature to us, it takes a lot of practice, but it's worth it, so worthwhile, because when we begin to do that more consistently, we catch ourselves going into the fear-based insanity of egos lashing out in order only to be attacked back again. insane strategy, and say, maybe you don't have to go there this time. Maybe I could see peace instead of this, and recognize that I'm not upset for the reason I think, which is that there's a world outside of me that's doing stuff to me. Mm-hmm. But in fact, this world, as the Eastern mystics correctly ascertained, is actually Maya or illusion, and in the sense that it's not the reality that we truly are, but it reflects one of two thought systems moment to moment, and that's where the gift is every moment, because we can respond to both calls for love and expressions of love with love, and that's a very helpful thing, isn't it? And that way we do see the world in a different light, and then it dissolves in a gentle smile and laughter rather than some kind of anguish.
Right. So you want to read the next paragraph?
Sure. The world was made as an attack on God. It symbolizes fear. And what is fear except love's absence? Thus the world was meant to be a place where God could enter not, and where his son could be apart from him. Here was perception born, for knowledge could not cause such insane thoughts. But eyes deceive, and ears hear falsely. Now mistakes become quite possible, for certainty is gone. I mean, even just on a really pragmatic physical level, we see at best one octave of who knows how many octaves of electromagnetic energy. So we just right there we have a limited range. You know, bees see ultraviolet, and probably other critters see infrared, and then our range of hearing, we hear about 10 octaves, and then we know that bats and smaller animals hear higher frequencies. Elephants, hear lower frequencies than we can hear. I mean, and then we occupy just this tiny little part of space and time. You know, in space, about a couple of meters, or 6 or 7 feet if you're particularly tall, at most, and not much more than that. Not even that much usually in terms of diameter, in terms of the space we occupy in a pretty good sized planet. And so we have just a little tiny bit of data coming in. Even if we immerse ourselves, as most people do nowadays, with all kinds of media and constantly glued to screens, which I was noticing on the plane and the shuttle and the rapid transit and the Lyft ride that I got here yesterday, as well as in the airport before I took off, everybody's glued to the screens. Well, we're mm-hmm. getting all kinds of information, but at best we're getting just the most minuscule subset of even the most objective, unbiased data. If we had only that. Even if we had it curated and carefully reported and assessed as to what was the most important things, we would still be falling way short of what we need to know to be anywhere close to having, as one of these later portions of the course suggests, having a valid basis for judgment. So as a first approximation, we're all basically clueless.
Right.
It doesn't mean we shouldn't use the information we have in the best way we can, but just to kind of gently laugh and say, yeah, because this world is designed to make us feel helpless and clueless and guilty and afraid and sinful and wicked and evil. and in most of those latter ones, mostly not consciously, but that's where it comes back to us in the form of things that bug us, because on some unconscious level, we think we committed this perfect cosmic crime and we've threw away the key to unlocking the way out, kind of thing. But
right.
But this attack on God is unfounded. This attack on the perfect oneness that this world seems to represent is just an appearance. And because we've glued ourselves to the interpretation that seems to suggest that this is all there is, not even considering the rest of the world, let alone the rest of the cosmos or the rest of the vast expanse of time, we see, if we take good care of ourselves, maybe a century out of how many countless millennia and billions of years this physical universe is supposed to be around. So, no matter what dimension you look at or what spectra of data, we're getting a pretty darn abbreviated view of things, even from the perspective of what this world is supposed to be about, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and what I was thinking as you were reading that paragraph, especially I'm trying to think what line it was. Well, maybe the world was made as an attack on God and it symbolizes fear. All of a sudden, what I could see is, when you see those pictures or you think about clubhouses. No boys allowed, no girls allowed, And all of a sudden I could see it. I mean, we are like little children and we built our little clubhouse and we've got this big sign across it. No God allowed, This is my space where I get to do what I want. And, I've created this little world and no God allowed.
and thinking about that logically, it's interesting you point that out, because thinking about that logically, if there's any kind of conception in our minds of God as being something like perfect oneness or complete inclusion or total acceptance admitting everyone into that club, so to speak.
Right.
Then anything that we do on the level of form in this world to, shut people out, not physically, because, if you have a potluck, you can't invite 7 billion people to your potluck. We're not talking about that. But in terms of in your heart and in your mind, if you think that there's better and worse people, or better and worse species of animals and plants, or different racial or gender or sexual orientations, or all those things become battlefields that the ego defends, you know, with great tenacity and passion, because as long as there's a difference, then we are basically in effect saying, I want to keep perfect oneness out of my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the attack on God. That's the attack. That's how we manifest an attack on that perfect oneness, is through attacking others, whether it's a judgment or it's even just a subtle criticism, or just a belief that our comparisons in terms of, you know, what we have and what other people have and have not, and you know, the pros and cons and the betters and the worses and all these comparative things just become ways to limit. I mean, it doesn't mean that we don't recognize the physical data. Obviously I appear to be in a male body and you appear to be in a female one. I'm looking out the window and I see a tree that has leaves that are mostly green and a sky that's kind of mostly gray. Those are factual sensory things that most people would, you know, tend to agree with. But it's not talking about that. It's just talking about the interpretation that gets tacked on. It's the metadata, if you will, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
some technical jargon there. It's the stuff that comes in to the camera, you know, when you're taking a photo, that where you add the comments like, you know, this is such and such somebody's seventh birthday. Now that might be factual, but you might also put in the notes, yeah, they had a stupid expression on their face. Well, that's an interpretation, right? So it's just kind of looking at that extra information that really becomes a filtering process where we truly distort and omit and censor the world to a degree that we're not even consciously aware of most of the time. And a lot of that censorship is done at the behest of this insane thought system we call the ego, for the purpose of just keeping us away from looking at the mind. Because mm-hmm. we think that there's something horrible in the mind, not mm-hmm. consciously usually, but we think that there's something terrible behind that cobweb festooned, dark, dusty trap door in our mind to the basement where, you know, the evil lurks, you know. And but if we take the hand of our inner kindness teacher and open it up, after maybe coughing on the dust a little bit as we open that trap door, you know, we discover that what appears to be this awful thing, when we pull away the facade of this dark stuff, there's just a perfect, immortal, infinite, eternal light that we all are and share behind that. And that is nothing to be afraid of. But we've made such a big deal of it, just like Wizard of Oz, you know, Dorothy and her comrades go into the Great Hall and hear the thunder and, you know, and how dare you defy the great and powerful, yada yada, you know?
Right.
But that's kind of the way that the world is set up, is to keep us constantly firefighting, constantly afraid, constantly scrambling to try to either make ends meet or to take care of a body that's failing and needs constant, you know, high maintenance attention, to deal with our relationships with each other that seem to demand all kinds of, you know, jumping through hoops, whether it's personal, professional, or whatever, and just look at that and laugh and say, wow, I'm making a big deal, as Shakespeare would say, you know, much ado of nothing. I'm making mm-hmm. a big deal of the thing. That doesn't mean that we can't, you know, kind of wipe our brow and sigh now and then, like, oh my gosh, all kinds of stuff is coming at us. But if we can just remember to laugh inwardly and say, wow, this world really is born out of an insane wish to be deceived. We actually want to be deceived by the world because it keeps us from looking at the inner, opening that inner door to the mind and seeing what we dread finding there, which is this morbid, horrific image. But behind that, which we discover as a facade when we look at it with that gentle teacher hand in hand, metaphorically, we realize it's just nothing. It's just this nothing to that terror. But we have to, you know, look at each encounter with a grievance, each encounter with something that rubs us the wrong way on the news, or a family encounter that or business encounter that you know, leaves us less than fulfilled and peaceful, and just say, wow, I'm doing it again. I'm making it about the dream rather than making it about the shared interest that we all have, that mm-hmm. ultimately is about being peaceful. And not, as Mr. Rogers said, he would not go there when it came to demeaning the true nature of each person. And the true nature is the nature we all share. And that's why, you know, this paragraph says, eyes deceive and ears hear falsely. And if we take our sensory data as an equation to our identity, then we're again using an extremely limited perspective for our identity. Because if we're beyond space and time and we're spirit and the mind that embraces that spirit is what we're returning to. If we see ourselves as anything less than that spirit, then we're you know, cutting ourselves short and cutting everybody else short. So mm-hmm. no point in that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to read the next one?
Yes. Let's see. The mechanisms of illusion have been born instead. And when they say instead, it's because in that previous paragraph, basically said, but our eyes deceive and our ears hear falsely, and now mistakes become quite possible, for certainty is gone. Mm-hmm. So then the mechanisms of illusion have been born instead, and now they go to find what has been given them to seek, which once again is such an important thing. You know, you said purpose, purpose of? No, I can't get the – yes, persevive, whatever. It's on purpose. It's on purpose. See, I think we want to – you know, we always want to see ourselves as innocent victims. We don't want to see that we're doing something on purpose. But see, we're giving those illusions a purpose to seek. Their aim is to fulfill a purpose which the world was made to witness and make real. They see in it its illusion, but a solid base where truth exists, upheld apart from lies. Yet everything that they report is but illusion, which is kept apart from truth. And I'm going to go on because I think this flows really nicely. As sight was made to lead away from truth, it can be redirected. Sounds become the call for God, and all perception can be given a new purpose by the one whom God appointed Savior to the world. And see, once again, I think that's so important because, you know, just as even what you were saying before, I'm thinking how often, you know, we want to, I mean, we use words, I think, sometimes to kind of screw with other people in terms of what our purpose is, our intention, but we so often won't even look at our own purpose. Mm-hmm. You know, what is, and as we've said, is your purpose separation or is your purpose oneness? What is your purpose? Is your purpose peace? And I can honestly say most of the time that's totally unconscious for me, but sometimes it's not.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes I'm just like, no, I don't want peace in this situation. No, I don't want to be with that person. I want this conflict because I want to prove that I'm an innocent victim. And the only way I can think of doing that is to make you wrong.
Exactly.
And right now, my purpose is to make you wrong and forget peace.
I'm laughing because what you're reminding me of a kind of the classic joke cliche is like, is this a private fight or can anyone join?
Yes. You know?
And I think we do that more often than we realize it. If we just kind of say, am I really wanting peace in this outcome, or am I wanting to continue to foment the battle and to, you know, and have I picked up a sword? You know, you look at your own hand, so to speak, metaphorically. Is there a sword mm-hmm. in it? You know, and mm-hmm. and I think this beloved curriculum asks us to keep looking and say, just notice if you picked up a sword, you know,
yeah.
and ask yourself, why do I want to do that? Why would I want to go there? You know, and just realize that it's all play. We're all like little puppets and little cartoon characters and dream figures and movie actors, you know, in a big giant sandbox of you know, ultimate consequence to truth. But we don't see that because we're so entrenched in our roles. We're such consummate actors and actresses in this world that we've thoroughly identified with these roles. And we think this is the real deal. I mean, this is serious stuff. And, you know, and it'd be silly to not, you know, acknowledge everyone's investment in that. But at the same time, if we can begin to shift ever so slightly away from the wanting to make the conflict the big deal to just recognizing that I could see peace instead of this, and wanting to share that. You know, then we can say, hey, you know, I was picking up a sword there. Maybe I can, you know, even mid-sentence at some point when, you know, something starts coming out of your mouth, you know, turn it around, as Byron Katie said, you know, just say, hey, wait a minute, you know, I think maybe I'm responsible for some of this, and I could do my part to make this situation, whatever my involvement is, whether it's just watching media about current political events or, you know, family or business conversation about whatever, or, you know, the way we drive on the road, or and letting vehicles go past and cut in when there's a merge lane, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Whatever. I mean, those things are all become opportunities, and there's every moment really becomes a perfect opportunity to practice that mindful awareness of, you know, seeing each moment is a time to undo the craziness, right?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, just always going back to recognizing we're a decision maker, because I mean, and I fully admit, a lot of times I pick up that sword and I'm ready to go. It feels good to me,
oh,
you know?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're all familiar with that, aren't we?
Yeah, must be those Aries planets. I'm going to blame it on that. But it's like, you know, yeah, I'm ready to go. But if you look at the base of it, why do I do that? Because I feel afraid. I feel afraid. I feel like I need a defense. I feel like if I don't defend myself, if I don't take up the sword, then I'm going to be cut down or whatever. And when we really stop and look at that and go, but what if we're wrong? What if that's not true at all? What if we don't need defense? What if we are really, really innocent and so are these other people?
Yes.
What if that's the truth? Then you know what? We can lay down the heavy sword. We can lay down the defense.
We really can. And as you're saying that, it occurs to me, this is another example of, if you just think about it logically, why would we, unless we believed in duality, and I'm going to kind of make a little digression into the metaphysics, of course, unless we believed in duality, what would there be to defend if there's nothing outside of a capital S self that's perfect oneness that A Course in Miracles suggests we all are and always have been and always will be, and only the only thing that argues against that is just about everything in our perceptual world here that says, no, that you're this body and you have this persona, and it's in conflict with all these other bodies who have different goals and different aims. And so, you know, you have to compete and stake your turf and prove your worth and, you know, earn every little scrap and morsel of success and it's all defined on you know, some kind of conquest. Well, what if there's no other? What if it's all one thing? What if we're all this one capital S self? There's nothing outside of that oneness to battle with. There's nothing to oppose what is just one.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we just kind of meditate on that once in a while, and then say, well, if that's really true, if I could begin to allow that idea into my mind and let it percolate, let it develop, let it grow until it becomes a consistent backdrop, and the certainty of that, which is the second paragraph that we've been reading, is what this is all about. If we know for sure that that's true, then ultimately we would have absolutely no reason to pick up the sword again and to go out, you know, crusading against some horrible wrong in the world. Doesn't mean we don't, you know, show up for jury duty if that's what we're called to do, or take part in an environmental cleanup or some, you know, political activism that we think might be helpful or whatever. But we can do it with a gentleness and with a recognition that in truth no one is guilty in spirit. Now on the level of form, you know, there may be, you know, people that might be, you know, the best thing in the world of this dream world of space time, the best thing might be for them to be, you know, locked up and you know, protect society as we think of it.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't mean that the persons that are doing the locking up or the persons that are locked up are any less than perfect spirit in truth. It just means that in the dream roles that we've accepted and we believe in and we've so identified with, they're playing that role in that charade, in that game. and that dramatization of a crazy mad idea. Mm-hmm. I think that's why in the section in Of Course in Miracles in the text that talks about the tiny mad idea, it I think it's the same paragraph that says, at which the Son of God remembered not to laugh. We forgot to laugh at the idea that separation was possible. And it's such a dim memory now that it's only occasionally for most of us that we get these reminders that, like, why, hey, I could, you know, choose a different teacher. I could choose a thought system that doesn't automatically have a knee-jerk reaction to pick up the sword and brandish the weapon and you know, hair prickling on the back of the neck and fangs out kind of thing.
Right.
But you know, if there's nothing to defend, if our true identity really is that oneness and that's a infinitely kind, loving, peaceful oneness, then it kind of makes this world looks pretty silly, and and not in not in a derisive way, but just kind of a gentle joke. It's like, wow, we believe this for such a long time, and ultimately we'll just walk out the door of this self-imposed jail, and recognize we've been playing the roles of jailer and prosecutor and you know
defender witness and the whole
courtroom, you know, the whole scenario, but the jurisdiction to begin with was faulty, and the Holy Spirit throws it out of court every time.
Right.
Metaphorically, yeah.
Well, for the sake of time, I am going to paraphrase what I think is the last paragraph of What is the World? Because I think this is an important concept in terms of turning things around. Basically, let us not rest content until we've changed our perception. We must save the world. And why must we save the world? Not because we need to change it, but because we need to change our perception. We're the ones who made it. We're the ones who set the interpretation, and we're the ones who can change the interpretation because we're decision makers. So that is a paraphrase, but that's where I'm going to leave it today. And Bruce, I want to say thank you so much for being here today. And do you have any announcements that you'd like to make before we close the show?
Yes. Yes.
Yes, as a matter of fact.
A quick one is that we're still working on the Miracle Share Conference updates, and we'll have that very soon. And that's going to be happening in October. In fact, in this next few days, I'm going to be making a recording of Judy Scutch Whitson, who's being part of this online conference. And we're very much looking forward to that. And lots of other familiar names and in the course world, and we're going to have a lot of fun with it. And you can always find the conversations that you and I have and several other course teachers on acimblog.com and also on the Facebook page that relates to that. And I, again, always appreciate these opportunities, CA, and thank you so much.
Well, thank you, and I look forward to talking to you again, and we'll see where we're going to go. Maybe we'll talk about what is the real world, which is one of the lessons that comes up in October. So we'll see how that goes. But Bruce, thank you so much.
Likewise.
Okay, and everybody in the chat room, thanks today for your pictures and your comments, and just thanks for showing up and being there. And but as I close the show, I will go ahead and post some of those websites that Bruce was talking about. But I would encourage you to stay tuned, because up next on 1-2 Radio is Kindred Spirits with Christy Brower. And I hope that you will join us again next week in our new time slot. And from the comments that you're putting in the chat room, I realize that our producer, Scott, did play last week's show, which was the Mark interview with Ken Wapnick, was playing it before this one. So maybe if you tune in on Tuesdays, you'll actually get a double dose, because you'll hear last week's show and this week's show of the Friday morning show. So those of you who love A Course in Miracles, I can't promise that, but maybe that's what we're going to be doing for a while until we get another show in that time slot. So thanks a lot to also Scott Weaver for being here today and taking care of all of that and just keeping everything on track. So everybody, I look forward to talking to you again soon. And until next week, relax and wear loose clothes. You have been listening to the Friday Morning Show with C.A. Brooks and my guest Bruce Rawls on 1-2 Radio, where we are changing the way you think about life and spirituality through the discipline of A Course in Miracles.